Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're listening to Real College Podcast. I'm your host for this episode, Tosin Fissimo. This week at RCP, we're looking into the student response to the protests that have sprung up around the Twin Cities. These protests began after George Floyd was killed during an arrest on May 25th. A Minneapolis police officer knelt on his neck, leaving Floyd without air for about 8 minutes. The incident was filmed and posted online, leading to protests throughout Minneapolis, which extended throughout the country, and eventually the world. The original protests began on Lake Street. Producer Casey McCabe has more.
On May 25th, then-Minneapolis Police Department officer Derek Chauvin kneeled on George Floyd's neck as he took his last breath. The video footage of Floyd's death went viral and resulted in massive protests throughout the Twin Cities and ultimately the world. A friend of mine who is a junior at the U attended the original protest on Lake Street the night of the 25th. For our purposes, she will be known as M. Here is what she saw.
I took the bus there, and so there was pretty much, it was maybe like 10 people on the bus, and the buses couldn't get like to the place that we needed to be because the streets were blocked off. So all 10 of us that were like going to the protest got off, and we started going towards the place where George was killed. And the closer you got, the more people were there. The streets weren't barricaded, but they were just full of people. When we got to the intersection where he was killed, there was a memorial with like flowers and notes and signs like right where he had was killed. And so that was really, really powerful to see. And there was people talking. There was someone who I think was a friend of his or knew him who was talking when I got there. And then there was a woman who said that the march was happening. So the march went all the way from where he was killed all the way to the precinct, the Minneapolis precinct. You know, there was a really, I would say it was a pretty good mix of people, you know, people of color, women. There was like kids in strollers that I saw, like with their parents. It was a very much like, you know, if you've ever been to protests like at the Capitol here in Minneapolis, or, you know, they're like family friendly events. Like there are things that parents take their kids to. They're not, you know, things that are violent in any way. And that's what it was like for those first couple hours, for sure.
The initial protest on the 25th was predominantly nonviolent. However, as the protest dragged on into the later hours of the night, M took note of how that energy changed.
But when we got to the precinct, there was already a lot of people there. And I would say for the first half hour of us being there, things were pretty low-key, pretty chill. And then it started off, people started throwing water bottles at the building itself. And then someone had gotten eggs from the Target that was, like, right across the road, and people started egging it. And then people started throwing rocks. And so I left when the rocks started being thrown, just for, like, personal safety reasons. Things were getting a little bit out of my personal comfort zone. It turns out that I think, like, 20 minutes after I left is when the tear gas started. The police started tear gassing protesters, and things have just kind of obviously, you know, devolved since then. Once we got there, you know, it was raining and it was getting later and darker and the rain was starting to come heavier. And I think, you know, having been out there for I don't know how many hours people had even been at the station, but for me at least, it definitely felt like, you know, we were yelling at this immovable object. You know, obviously nothing was going to change when we were out there, and the goal was to indicate that this was not okay and that we were not going to just stand silently and allow this man to die in vain. And I think when the energy changed, it certainly wasn't to me, you know, like everyone all of a sudden. It was a couple people that were getting a little bit more violent, and I, you know, heard other people saying, don't throw things, you know, let's keep this like professional. But being in those situations, I don't know what it's like to be a black person and to have my safety questioned by people that are supposed to keep me safe.
As the protests, both peaceful and otherwise, have escalated in the Twin Cities, the burning emotion that set the city ablaze has spread. Here in my hometown of Madison, Wisconsin, this took the form of a peaceful protest outside of the Capitol on May 30th. That's the sound of thousands of peaceful protesters assembled outside of the Dane County Jail. During the protest, I was able to speak with Marcus Johnson, a local activist and organizer of the peaceful protest in front of the Capitol. Johnson explained why people are still protesting, even though former officer Derek Chauvin is in custody.
The biggest reason for us being out here is because of equality. People need to be held accountable for their actions, and I think we all agree on that. But when the people that are supposed to protect and serve us, the people with a great amount of power, are not held to the same extent that we are, then you can see why the people are frustrated, especially, you know, these actions aren't new, but us having phones and being able to capture every moment is new. And now people are seeing it all the time. You know, I think COVID-19, as much of a burden as it was good because it let people get away from the distractions, forced you to realize what's going on. Because even in the pandemic, people are still getting murdered by the police. And even if it happens, they need to be held accountable. And the justice system keeps sending the message that it's okay. And that's why we're here, to show that it's not okay. And until we get the same treatment, or the officers get the same treatment as the public, when it's so visibly clear and evidential on tape, then I think people are going to be very mad, and they're going to keep doing this.
During the protest, Johnson outlined the varied goals of demonstrators and what steps need to be taken moving forward.
Everyone's got a little bit of a different angle. Me personally, and I think the overall umbrella is just holding people accountable, right? If you do something, if you break the law, no matter who you are, badge or not, gun or not, you have to pay that price. You got to see the judge. But for me personally, I think the best way to start going in that direction, people could have the resources they need, and people don't have the resources they need. And I think a big part of that is because we can show up like this when we're angry, but on our own, we're never angry enough sitting at home when we can't pay our bills, or if life hits us wrong and there's no way out of it. So I think if people could start realizing that if they come together like this, and we could vote for our mayors, we can vote for our chief of police, our aldermen, all the people in positions, especially on the lower level, that get to dictate what happens and it shoots its way up the ladder, we control that.
Much like the Twin Cities, Madison has its own history of police violence. In 2015, Tony Robinson, an unarmed black teen, was shot and killed by a Madison police officer. To get an idea of why Tony's death has shaped the black community's perception of police in Madison, I talked to my good friend Peyton Agard, a friend of the Robinsons.
Because in the situation in Madison, it never really got justice in that type of way. And so I feel like, in a way, we're moving in the right direction. But I think that the whole system is f***ed. After he got killed, they put the officer that killed him, Matt Kenny, they put him on paid administrative leave for like 4 or 5 months, I think. And then, so we did a bunch of protests, and like we went to the Capitol, and like there were protests out in Milwaukee. I heard it got like I didn't go to the ones in Milwaukee, but my older brother did, and he told me they kind of got like a little bit wild, like people were throwing rocks at like the police and all that type of stuff. After like a year and a half, 2 years, I think, the case got dropped against him. But my friend's mom, she filed a lawsuit against the state, and then in the end, I think she got like $2 million or something like that. But like, money doesn't really make up for the fact that like her son just got murdered in cold blood.
As protests continue to rock Madison and the Twin Cities, we are reminded that those who have had their lives taken from them are not merely hashtags on social media, but a beloved son, daughter, or friend. Reporting for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe.
UMN student group Students for a Democratic Society organized a protest on May 29th. I went down to check out what happened. The night started with a large crowd gathering in front of Northrop Auditorium. Over the course of about a half hour, numerous students spoke in front of the crowd. Each was from a different student group, and each had something different to say. Their reactions ranged from sadness to anger, but all expressed an emphasis on achieving justice, not just for George Floyd, but all of the individuals who had died at the hands of the police. After all the speakers had delivered their speeches, protest organizers directed the crowd's movement toward the University of Minnesota Police Department building.
Okay, now we're marching from the steps of Northrop through campus, and we are all heading to the police station.
The crowd was loosely scattered across Washington Avenue. Some protesters stood directly on the light rail tracks in front of the police building. Others chose to be a little further away from the action.
But yeah, 40 minutes till curfew. We'll see what happens.
A few minutes in, I noticed a small drone above our heads. Nearby, a guy with a handheld device appeared to be controlling the drone and using it to take a video. The guy, whose name is Larson Cole, explained what he was up to.
I couldn't help but notice you had a drone with a camera on it. What's that about?
So, I just graduated from the U of M. My grandparents sent me a check unexpected, and instead of paying for rent, which I should have done, I bought a drone, just sort of like a fun purchase, and I've had it for about 2 weeks now, and this felt like the perfect opportunity to sort of like, you know, shoot some footage. This is like illegal, what I'm doing right now.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, but we're also not allowed to like walk on the railroad tracks and just block up the road. So, but yeah, it's like full support of the protest. I don't support the looting, but like, in the sense that like you don't want anyone's property getting damaged, especially if it's like a small business. Yeah.
At this point, it was about half an hour until the 8 p.m. curfew.
A bunch of cops just showed up, so the crowd is dispersing. But, I mean, it's not 8 p.m. yet, so not everyone is leaving. But it looks like some of the protesters are going up right up to the cops.
I began to wonder if the situation would escalate, but things stayed pretty calm.
Everyone is lined up in front of the crowd, or in front of the police. It's still peaceful as of right now. But a few people are getting a little closer to the police officers, yelling in their faces. Yeah, the crowd is moving along, I think, to 4th Street. Most of the cops appear to be retreating. Most of the crowd has left, but a few of the police officers are kind of just reorienting themselves, maybe following the crowd or something.
Closer to the front, a young woman was encouraging some of the more upset protesters to avoid getting angrier and to follow along with the now departing crowd.
My name is Missy Rowan. I am a student here at the U. I'm also a member of the Anti-War Committee, which is a part of the Justice for Jamar Coalition. I can't talk. These police officers came out as we were leaving. We were already marching away, and they came out to instigate a problem because they want to bust some heads at 8 o'clock. They are waiting 20 minutes till it's 8 o'clock so that they can have an excuse to come in and attack this protest. We were leaving. This whole thing was done, and they didn't come out until they saw us leaving because they knew that we were leaving, and they want to bust some heads. So this is about instigating a violent scene, and we did not start this. I'm not telling these people what to do. These people are angry, and that is totally justified, but I'm just saying, this is not, this. We did not do this, they did this, okay?
After a few more minutes, most of the stragglers left, myself included. The next morning, I spoke on the phone with SDS member Jayla Lyman to discuss in further detail what happened at the end of the protest.
And at about 7:40, we gave an announcement to everyone, like, there's an 8 o'clock curfew. We, like, don't want anybody getting arrested and stuff. We can't force you to go, but we can also just let you know so that people are prepared. So then at that point, it was about 7:45-ish, and we started walking away because for people who were willingly going to break curfew, we were going to go to 4th Street so that we were in a bigger group so that we'd be less easily targeted by the police. But as we were leaving, there was a line of about 10 police officers standing there trying to intimidate us. And you could tell that they were just waiting until that 8 o'clock hit to basically sit and mess with us. There was two UMPD officers who were standing there with their hands over their AR-15s.
Jayla echoed the concerns voiced by some of the protesters when they saw the UMPD officers bring out their weapons.
I felt like it was very excessive, and they were trying to use intimidation tactics for us just expressing our right to protest. What we were protesting was the defunding and disarming of the UMPD, because as we see, they have these weapons for what? Like, they clearly didn't need them, yet they were using them to try to intimidate us, and we shouldn't be intimidated on a campus that we pay tens of thousands of dollars to be on. So we just got everybody to go because we didn't want it to go south. By about 7:50, we all started walking back towards 4th Street.
The student protests didn't end up escalating beyond that, but around Minneapolis, many people who have joined protests have been arrested. To discuss options for people who have gotten into legal trouble for protesting, I spoke to Carmen McQuitty, a lawyer for Student Legal Service, a law firm on campus specifically for UMN students. She first explained to me what legal consequences people can face for being involved in protests.
Things shifted whenever Governor Walz implemented the curfew. So if folks are out after curfew, they could receive a curfew violation, which is a misdemeanor, low-level offense. The cops give a dispersal order and you don't leave, that's another criminal charge. And that typically is the one we tend to see folks get when they're protesting, is that it's like a failure to disperse.
Protesters can be treated differently in court based on their record. Prosecutors can look into whether someone is on probation or if they have a history of protesting.
The way that the criminal justice system works is that prosecutors look at, whenever they're trying to resolve a case with plea deals, they look at a person's, quote, criminal history to decide what to make an offer. And if they see a person, you know, if they see somebody with a, quote, unquote, clean record, never involved in protest, they just look more favorably upon that. Versus a person who they have said, oh, this is like a seasoned protester. This is sort of what they do. They're just less likely to give good deals to people that they've tagged as, you know, sort of professional protesters.
I asked Carmen what advice she would give to students who are considering getting involved with protests.
First, my advice is, if you're going to go out and protest, my recommendation is that you take any medication that you have to take, bring it with you in case you get swept up and you have to go to jail. Let people know what you're doing and that you're going to be out there. Have an emergency contact, not on your phone, but that you actually write with a Sharpie on your arm or somewhere else on your body. Because if you get taken to jail, they're going to take your phone and you need to be able to call somebody. There's a lot of folks who are doing jail support right now. So, and jail support means that there could be somebody there to bail you out, pick you up from jail. So if you're going to go out and protest and you're willing to, you know, if you're not going to leave right away if they tell you to, and if you're not going to follow the curfew, have your jail support plan in place. So have somebody you know you're going to call with some money.
I also asked her how students can reach out to Student Legal Service after getting arrested for protesting.
Once you get out of jail, so Student Legal Service, we're not like a 24-hour on-call service, unfortunately. So we're not the people to do jail support. But once you get out, you can either go to our website or email USLS. At umn.edu, and absolutely they will hook you up with an appointment probably to talk to me. If you were planning to protest and you wanted advice, you could always send us an email ahead of time and we can talk through some strategies with you as well. But we absolutely represent students who have been swept up in protests, 100%.
Carmen emphasized that for those who are worried about the possibility of having a record after being arrested, the consequences aren't as severe as one may think.
I encourage everybody to exercise their First Amendment rights appropriately and know that the consequences aren't that bad. So if you get arrested, because students are always concerned about their record, which makes perfect sense at this stage in your life. And typically, unless you're doing arson or looting, you know, the charges aren't that serious. And we can likely get the record sealed down the road anyways. I'm not certainly condoning anything, but just, I mean, that's often another concern for people is what is this going to do to my record?
For more information on how to get legal support as a U of M student, You can email Carmen directly at kmcquitty@umn.edu or head to the Student Legal Service website. In a demand for justice, many have chosen to protest directly outside the homes of the officers who were present during the arrest and death of George Floyd. RCP volunteer John Kippers spoke to some of these protesters.
There are no words I can come up with that would be sufficient enough to sum up not only what's been going on in Minneapolis over this past week, but what has been a long-standing history of police brutality and racism within the United States. As a white straight male who is allotted every privilege and is sheltered from any form of discrimination, I must acknowledge this platform given to me by this society and use it to actively listen to those who are impacted by these tragedies in ways I will never know. To do just that, I spoke with members of the Twin Cities community who have been on the front lines during various protests this past week, including one at the residence of the cop who killed George Floyd on Monday, May 25th.
My name's Darren Badua. I'm 18 years old, and I go to Johns Hopkins University.
My name's Susenio Siemer. I'm 19, and I attend Princeton University.
We went to Derek Chauvin's house in Oakdale, and as we arrived on the scene, obviously several cops, militia, everyone was armed, and they were like protecting all around his house, and you had about maybe 100 people in the crowd. It was very peaceful. Obviously people were yelling at the cops, emotional, but no one was throwing anything. Unlike at the precinct, when it got a bit crazy, but this one was quite peaceful. And so we get there and, we're obviously joining the chants and, you see the cops like face to face, and it's really like, it seemed like they were defending a killer. Like, that's how it felt in my eyes.
I asked Darren and Sosenios what parts of that protest seemed to stand out to them.
Yeah, I think one of the craziest moments while we were there protesting that at Chauvin's home was this point where there was this lady, and she was screaming at the cops. And she was talking about how overtime wasn't worth what they were doing, and like they can stand here and say it's just their job, but this is way bigger than their job. This racial divide is hundreds of years old. And at one point, when the officer breaks down and he starts crying, he doesn't start bawling or anything, but you just see tears dribble down his face. And he starts talking to one of his fellow officers, and after a second he steps out of line, a new one takes his place, and he walks to the far back where you can't see him. And it was so crazy, because like you see someone who's crying, and so you assume they know what they're doing is wrong, but they don't stop. He was unable to stand up for what was right when it mattered most.
Actually, at one point, this black man, probably like, I think he was in his 20s, really early 20s, and he came in a suit and a ponytail. He had dreads, but he had it up in a ponytail. And immediately he comes and he starts like crying and explaining like why he had to come here dressed like the way he was, because he's seen as a threat otherwise. So he had to present himself in a professional manner, have his hair up in a ponytail, just so they can look at him as another, you know, human, and not just some, you know, black person that they can provoke or arrest. So he had a really powerful message, and he was talking about how he wants to be a firefighter, and he's going to be stepping into this like law enforcement community, and he just thought it was so sad that the profession that he wants to step into is killing his own people.
Throughout this week of protesting, a lot of cops perpetuated the feeling of disappointment and hopelessness onto those protesting through their actions or lack of.
And the first thing we see is this woman talking to one of the officers. And she's talking about how if the officers are for the people and racism is against the people, then can the officer say that he's against racism? And we proceeded to watch them struggle on this topic for 10, 15, 20 minutes.
Although one officer in particular seemed to provide a sense of surprising comfort for both Darren and Sosenios.
There's some commotion happening by the U.S. Bank. So we head over there and we're walking around trying to find where everyone is. And eventually we turn a corner and run to two black officers. And at first we don't pay mind to them and keep on walking, but some people in our group lagged behind or talking to them. So we turn around and we start talking to them. And this is where Darren actually started asking the officer really specific questions about their blackness and their role in the city and their opinions on how people are responding to the situation and what's happening right now.
I talked to them about how at first I was pissed because I was like, okay, how did this guy get on paid leave like before he got fired? And the cop was like, no, like I fired him. And I was like, no, like I saw that like he was on paid leave and like they eventually fired him. He's like, you're actually talking to the chief of the Minneapolis Police Department. And I was like, whoa. Like, I had no idea.
We all took a step back. We're like, what?
Yeah. So once I heard that, I had even deeper questions because I'm like, how, as a black man and as being the chief in Europe, and you are the face of an organization that everyone is against right now, how do you feel about that? And so I started asking him about, in specific, the three bystanding officers, and he was like, well, and I literally a couple minutes ago, I saw him on CNN talking about the same exact thing. And he told me, he was like, well, like police officers are supposed to be a family, right? And if someone in your family member is doing something wrong, why would you turn a blind eye to it? So he said silence was just as much of a weapon as what the officer that had his knee on George Floyd's neck for 8 minutes. It was the exact same thing.
Finally, I asked Darren and Sosenios if they had any last messages they would like to share.
Right now, show solidarity with the protesters. Go out and protest. Go help them protest. Keep them safe. I think ultimately the most important thing to do is to look inside yourself and to really scrutinize how you treat other races and other ethnic groups. And really try to see if there's any pattern of microaggressions or racial tendencies against them. And work on that, because ultimately that's what's most important.
Don't be comfortable in being complicit. If you value discourse, then have discourse with your friends about it. If you value helping out the community, like Sonny said, go help out the community. If you value you making signs and making artwork about it, you go do that. But there has to be something that you can do that you can show support for a obvious just cause.
The good fight reaps rewards, and we're not there yet, and we're going to keep on fighting until we get what's right, but we're going to fight.
For Real College Podcast, this is John Kippers.
In times like these, art can be a way for people to express their emotions. UMN student Zoe Challenger wrote a poem titled The Shakespearean Tragedy of the American Tale.
Many ogle at the tragedy that is the American tale. The animals outside peer into the cages guarded by screens with a hypnotic blue haze to see choreographed images of members of their own kind in a performance riddled with the destiny of failure. Once upon a time, the waltz of false truths had projected prosperity by the name of God, whose American identity made him seem second to none. And by his blessing, no animal was forced to understand the woes of the good in reference to the bad. But when the music was stopped and cold feet seized the continuation of the beat, a prelude intertwining fear and utmost necessity revealed the tragic hero of the black man, whose message was loud and clear. America should have never been built beneath the light of a total eclipse. For its selfish desires masking a totalitarian gaze should have never been a secret the moon had to bear. Its allegiance to the sun is not worth a few stars and stripes. And in its all-encompassing power, the light must be shown. No longer will there be limited view to the facade that the wealthy have of all kinds have used to grow. But the black man is the hero that he did not ask to be. He is a being like all behind the cages and onlookers who pretend to be free. We is to them. All are we to them. Isn't it funny how you and me, how you try to say the tragic hero represents all of our sun-kissed bodies? Only when we can get a smile out of it. Maybe even a shiny tooth or two for you. Most just might forget how we did not ask to so willingly open our black bodies for all to see. Bleeding red, but without white or blue. The demise of the American mammal was never too good to be true. Perfection is a game where all players are bound to lose. Such a pity to see us all die as pawns to the misunderstandings of right and wrong. Those who have forsaken vulnerability and all American faces have led us to the valley of death. But by her mighty tongue, my deviant life does not rely on if, but rather when. So, Miss America, when your time comes, shall I save you a seat where the sun won't shine?
That's all for this episode of Real College Podcast. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It's produced by me, Tosin Fissimo. Casey McCabe is the managing editor. Thanks to John Kippers and Zoe Challenger for their contributions. All episodes of the podcast can be found online at RadioK.org or on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening.